Well, I'd like to start by saying that perimeter is a very special place, but it's important to reflect on how privileged we are for the researchers to be able to study a topic that we're all passionate about, for our admin colleagues to be part of our mission of advancing science. Our privilege, like almost all others, comes at the expense of others. Perimeter is located in the Waterloo region here in Ontario in Canada. This is the direct benefit of policies towards the Indigenous peoples who were the original inhabitants of this area, and it is our responsibility to acknowledge and to understand this history and allow this understanding to guide our actions. Land acknowledgements are just one small first step in doing this work. A land acknowledgement is an act of reconciliation, and it's an opportunity to recognize the Indigenous inhabitants of the land where we work and we live. In the spirit of understanding and learning from what has come before, Perimeter respectfully acknowledges that we are located on the traditional territory of the Atanawandran, Anishinaabe, and Haudenosaunee peoples. Perimeter is situated on the Haldimand Tract, land promised to the Six Nations, which includes 6 miles on either side of the Grand River. As settlers, we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. We in this room are connected in our collective commitment to make the promise and the challenge of truth and reconciliation real in our community. As part of these efforts, Perimeter's hosted several events this week in recognition of tomorrow's National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, a day to recognize the history and ongoing effects of Canada's residential school system. Today, I want to thank you for joining us for this special colloquium with Hilding Nielsen. Hilding is an astrophysicist who studies and thinks deeply about the intersections of astronomy and Indigenous knowledge. I'd also like to thank the Anti-Racism Working Group, and in particular, Aaron Saz, who's hopefully on Zoom in the airport watching us right now. I'm thanking them for their work in making this colloquium happy. Now, turning to our speaker, Hilding earned his PhD at the University of Toronto studying Cepheid stars. He held postdoctoral fellowships at the Argelander Institute for Astronomy in Bonn and East Tennessee State University. He was an assistant professor at the University of Toronto from 2014 until just earlier this year, but just recently he moved to become an assistant professor at Memorial University in his home province of Newfoundland. In this journey, Hilding has rediscovered his Mi'kmaq heritage and strives to integrate Indigenous knowledge and methodology in better understanding the stars, the universe, and our place in it. I'm supposed to also remind or tell you that, as well as today's talk, Hilding's going to be giving a cosmology seminar on the Drake equation tomorrow afternoon at 1:30 in the Bob Room. And so if you like what you hear today, I encourage you to come to that talk tomorrow afternoon. In any event, we're delighted that Hilding is here to share his ideas with us, and so please join me in giving Hilding a warm welcome to the Perimeter Institute.
I hope everyone can hear me. Perfect. So thank you very much for inviting me to be here today. It's very wonderful to come to Waterloo, to be on the land of the Anishinaabe, Haudenosaunee, and the Neutral Peoples, and I hope being here I get to be a good guest and a good visitor. You know, it's very important that we talk about all these different things, and tomorrow is a very important day that we should recall or remember is focused primarily on the residential school survivors, 60 Scoop survivors, and missing murdered Indigenous women and children. And that we should be thinking about that every day. So hopefully tomorrow we all have orange shirts and honor the day appropriately. Today, I want to talk to you a little bit about astronomy and colonization, and in particular, how we think about space and astronomy in terms of the land and indigeneity. It's worth noting that, and I think this was in Rob's speech a little bit, that indigenous peoples have been on this land since time immemorial. Now we can argue what that means in so many different ways, but you know, even the most cynical person, scientists or anthropologists would say at least 10,000 years. Archaeological evidence, 20, 30,000 years. And if people have been living on this land for tens of thousands of years, that means the people have developed a very deep and significant relationship with the land they're on. And wherever we are, it's those people are, there were people. Whether it's Mi'kmaq people in the east, Salish in the west, Anishinaabe, Cree, Inuit, Dene, and so on. Every piece of land that we call Canada today is indigenous. And every piece of land has a culture, it has people reflecting in it, and a long history of world traditions. That includes the night sky. You know, imagining you have cultures and telling stories every night for centuries and millennia, reflecting emotions of the night sky, whether it's the planets, stars, comets, etc., you will develop a very fine knowledge, a detailed, intimate relationship with the night sky that tells us a lot of information and carries both information about the people and the sky with it. And it's important we think about that. As we are sitting here in Waterloo or Toronto or wherever, this the relationship with the land is there and is reflected in the sky. Indigenous people tell stories. And those stories aren't just myths or entertainment. It's knowledge. It's transmission of knowledge that reflects the land we're on. And we can connect to that land through the stories we tell and or through the astronomy because that the stories depend on where we are. Even if we're in the simplest case, think or in the most extreme case, you know, we tell stories here about the night sky, but if we go to Australia, what stories are we going to tell? Or we're in the high Arctic, what stories are we going to tell? Even the most simplest stories or most basic observations change depending where we are. You know, we always talk about the moon and the phases of the moon. Well, if you're in the southern hemisphere, it goes the other way. And so your stories change, whether maybe from a man on the moon to an ant in the moon, or something to that effect. So our stories depend on where we live and where we are. And this is because these stories carry basically methodologies. They carry ways of understanding. Not that dissimilar to how we think about the scientific method. And it's worth noting, first and foremost, there is no one indigenous method. The word indigenous is a catch-all phrase. To catch every person who's of these lands or other lands in one kind of phrase. You know, there are Mi'kmaq, there are Cree, there are some Ottawa, and so on, peoples. So there's no one pan-indigenous system. But there's many commonalities. And we can, scholars have written and sort of discussed many axioms or methodologies that indigenous peoples use. And there are many, many versions of these kind of ideas. And this here list is just a simple, kind of quick guide. You know, when I mentioned the stories in the moon, you know, what's above is reflected below. The stories of the night sky reflect the land you're on. And you know, even looking at the constellations in our sky, in the western sky, you can see some of that. For many indigenous people, knowledge is a relationship. That always sounds kind of weird to me. But you know, when we think about how we do knowledge in our science labs or experiments, et cetera, we're trying to obtain an answer, we're trying to gain something. It's like it's something that would be owned. But for many indigenous peoples, knowledge is a relationship. It is an act, it is a verb, it's something you do every day. I think what's really interesting, most interesting though, or one of the most interesting ideas, is one of the ideas is that we kind of, in the West, try to break things down into single variables. You know, if I have an experiment with 10 levers, I just vary one and see what happens. Then I'll vary the other and hold everything else constant. You know, where we try to isolate variables. But for many indigenous peoples, The idea is to operate concurrently, to think about the relationship of many things at once. And a very good example of this comes from caribou migration. I don't know how many of you are familiar with caribou. I know I'm betting you're all familiar with reindeer, which are their cousins. But caribou migrate across northern Quebec, Labrador, Northwest Territories, etc., and herds, and they travel hundreds of miles, hundreds of kilometers. And almost every year that migration path is different, for whatever reason. And until recently, the best computer simulations, best scientists couldn't figure out why they changed or how they changed, couldn't make predictions. The elders knew. The elders knew how the migration path would go, and they knew how to manipulate it. Because they could see all the variables working together. They intuitively knew how the caribou would migrate, and that's because they understand all the variables that are happening. For many Indigenous peoples, knowledge is holistic. And I don't mean holistic necessarily in a religious sense, though it could be. But holistic in that we think about everything. As noted, I spent a long time at the University of Toronto. You know, if you go to that campus, you can visit the Department of Astronomy, which is next door to the Department of Physics, down the street from the Department of Chemistry, across the road from the Engineering Department, and so on. Everybody's in their own little silo. The knowledge is compartmentalized and siloed. And we spend so much time, I think, in modern academia talking about interdisciplinaryship or transdisciplinaryship and bridging these gaps. But for many Indigenous peoples, knowledge is holistic. A story about the sky is also a story about health or ethics and so on. It's worth noting also, and this may be the most important, is how many Indigenous peoples view nature. I think in the West, there's a hierarchical sense of nature. Humans are the top of the pyramid. Then maybe animals, then fish, then maybe plants. Whereas for many Indigenous people, everything is important, everything is equal and familial. For many Indigenous peoples, the bear, the tree, the salmon are not something that is other. They're family, they're cousins, they're relations. And so they have equal rights and equal place. And that changes a lot of how the world gets viewed in that lens. But I also want to highlight again, there is no one pan-Indigenous system. Every Indigenous nation is different, has their own set of beliefs, own context, in the same probable way that everyone in this room has a very different opinion about something very specific. And it wouldn't take much to create an argument. That's just the way it is. You know, we all come from different places. But it's valuable to think about these things because these ideas complement what I would say what is Western traditional science. And I like throwing the word traditional in the Western sense because we tend to do that for Indigenous knowledge and that with the point of making Indigenous knowledge is historical. Indigenous knowledges exist today. Whether it is how people burn fires to prevent larger forest fires or how they catch fish to preserve other fish and so on. But these axioms complement Western traditional science. One example of this is the sun dagger. The sun dagger is a construct that was built in a cave in the southern United States in the desert. Today it is on Navajo territory. But in this cave, a little bit of a small cave, it has an opening facing eastern direction. And in front of that opening were placed three pieces of slate that were angled in such a way. At the back of the cave, where the sun would hit every day, there were drawn these two spirals, one smaller and one larger. And in this picture, you see really what is really two pictures overlaid, depending on which season you're looking. You're looking at, for instance, I believe the summer solstice, you get the very bright daggers from the sunlight. And if you're looking at an equinox, you'll get the dimmer stripes. This became a very powerful solar calendar, very appropriate for telling time on a land that in the desert, so people can plan celebration, ritual, etc. But it's not just a calendar, it's also a map. The spirals aren't arbitrarily drawn. their paths. In a similar way, we might think Cartesian coordinates east, west, north, south. These spirals are inwards and outwards. It tells you which way to go if you need to leave there to go somewhere else. So both a calendar and a map at the same time. If we move to another place, let's say the high north, Inuit have lived there for thousands of years. I think for most of us, the high north would be considered a very harsh environment, a very difficult place to survive. And so you need to have an intimate relationship with the land. In this case, if you're very far north, this is what the night sky would look like. You would see Orion, the Big Dipper, and so on. But if you look near the horizon in the south, you'll see a star called Sigirik, which I totally mispronounced. I apologize. But watching the star is important. There's a story that this is not a star, but two foxes, a red fox and a white fox. And they're playing, chasing each other's tail. So that all you see is the blurs of red and white flashes back and forth, or twinkling. And depending on how much is twinkling, you know whether there's a high pressure system or a low pressure system coming in. The star is a weather predictor. Kind of important if you have to worry about snowstorms. Now, this isn't the only navigational guide or a weather map. You know, the Inuit also combine that with snowdrifts, ice flows, wind directions, and so on. It was a holistic method to understand what was going on. So not, it wasn't just one piece of information, but lots working together. From another source, this is the Bighorn Medicine Wheel. Medicine wheels are constructs seen all over the prairie provinces and northwestern United States, used by indigenous peoples for many reasons, ceremony, ritual, and so on. The Bighorn Medicine Wheel is one of the largest. It exists today, still used for ritual by local peoples in Wyoming. But it has been argued by an archaeologist, or astroarchaeologist, depending on how grandiose you want to sound, that this is actually a calendar. And you can sort of see how this works. There is a central point with spokes coming out in every direction around the circle. And at different points at the edge of the circle are little spots where you can stand. And so if you're standing at one of those outside points and you follow the spokes, you can trace the rising and setting of the sun and different stars. So if you look closer, this is what Jack Eddy did in the 1970s. He argued that if you're standing at different points, you can follow the rising and setting of Aldebaran, Rigel, Sirius, and Fomalhaut. And this was a way of mapping the summer solstice with an accuracy of days, which is kind of a very valuable sense for timekeeping and ceremony. Now, what's fascinating about this is that it doesn't work anymore that way. Because of precession, the alignments are shifted. So this would have been used for timekeeping a few centuries ago. Though, however, it's worth noting, this was work done by Jack Eddy as an archaeologist. This isn't indigenous knowledge. The medicine wheel is used for ceremony and so much more. So we see different stories and different purposes, and they all work together. This is probably one of my favorite stories, so I'm going to tell it. And I'll probably tell it again tomorrow, because I can. This is a story of Muin and the Seven Bird Hunters. This comes from Mi'kma'ki out east. And this story tells us a lot about the land and the people on it. So you can see the pattern of the bear and the hunters. And above, you'll see the constellation that looks a lot like the Big Dipper. In this situation, the bear, Muin, is the four stars of the bowl. Following Muin is Robin, the hunter, and so on with the other birds. And we tell the story not just in one night. Tell it all throughout the year. Because we know that in one night, the Big Dipper, as a circumpolar star, will go around the night sky one time, and it will do it every night. But if we tell the story over the year, and we tell it at the same time of day, it'll go around the night sky again, but across the whole year instead. And so we tell the story throughout the year, usually around 5 in the morning or so. Not my best time in the day, but, you know, each their own. And we start in the spring. And in the spring, Muin is waking from hibernation. And if you sleep for months on end, you're probably going to be hungry too. So Muin emerges from her cave looking for food when she's spotted by Robin. And Robin knows that Muin will feed the community and the elders for months. The grease of Muin will serve the community, protect them as well. And so Robin grabs his bow and arrow and calls his friends. Following quickly is Chickadee with his basket or pot. And if you look closely, Chickadee being the second star in the arm of Big Dipper is two stars. So the pot is itself a star. And then so on, followed by the other bird hunters. They go through the hunt and chasing Muin throughout the spring. And as they get through summer, Muin is running across the land as the birds try to keep chase. The summer is long and hot, but they continue the hunt. As they get towards fall, the birds in the back have lost track of the hunt because they're below the horizon at this time. Muin is tired and exhausted, getting frustrated, and Muin rises on his hind legs and growls. Robin, spying an opportunity, fires his arrow, striking Muin in the chest. Blood goes everywhere, covering Robin. Robin flies up to the tree, shakes off as much blood as he could, staining the leaves red, but leaving the one spot on his chest. Muin dies. And the birds come together. They hunt. They commit the hunt together. They cook together. They celebrate together. They start telling stories together. And as into the winter, when Muin's on his back waiting for the summer. But they're telling these stories, keeping each other warm through the long, cold nights. And we tell that story because it contains so many lessons and knowledges. And if you remember what I mentioned about these axioms, where I now have the citation, we can actually talk about all the different ideas. You know, the hunt is a reflection, the hunt in the sky is a reflection of the sky below. The relationship, the different variables, the familiarity of nature, they all work together, teaching us ethics and stars and hunting and animals and nature. These knowledges and methods provide valuable insights into our place in the universe. But I'm going to go on a limb and say these weren't in your physics, modern physics classes. They weren't in your quantum mechanics classes. Certainly weren't in your electricity and magnetism classes, were they? Technically, we tend to ignore them in our sciences. And that's a shame, because this is an insight that runs parallel and independent of how we do Western science. Yet we ignore them. And we ignore them because of colonization. We live on this land that is indigenous. People were removed, in this case, from here to Six Nations. And this is linked to colonization. The story doesn't exist because we view the same constellations differently. And this is not, there we go. And instead of a bear and seven bird hunters, we view the night sky as a stick figure with a tail. Ursa Major is the constellation that we tend to talk about in our classrooms and our books, because not even a century ago now, a group of astronomers under the auspices of the International Astronomical Union came together and said, here are the 88 constellations in the night sky. And if I remember my history correctly, the committee was composed of a British man, a French man, and a German man. So, you know, the beginning of a bad joke. And this is what we use for constellations. Instead of the stories, we have a sanitized map. And as such, our view of the night sky is colonized, meant to remove ourselves from that relationship of the dark skies and so on. And I don't know how many of you have taught introductory astronomy. I know I've done it a few times now. Our textbooks are no better. This is a very commonly used cosmic perspective textbook on astronomy, you know, your 101, 201, your art students' astronomy. And maybe two pages of this contains indigenous knowledges. Out of hundreds. One of those pages will be Stonehenge. Maybe part of it is the statues on Rapa Nui in Easter Island. But they don't really talk about anything. They glaze over it and for a moment as ancient astronomy and then move on to the real story. This is erasure. This is not unique to astronomy, but this erasure exists, and it is colonization. And we continue this forward. This is where I grew up. This is outside of Corner Brook, Newfoundland, overlooking the, you can't see the city of Corner Brook because that would be to our right, overlooking what's called the Bay of Islands. And this is a statue of a very famous explorer, one James Cook. Now we know James Cook is famous for his efforts in the Pacific, but he spent a long time, a number of years, mapping the coast of the island of Newfoundland. So the word Cook is all over the map where I grew up. And in his honor, we built the statue, and for some reason, he's facing inland instead of the ocean. Part of the reason he was famous for his work in Newfoundland is because he observed a lunar eclipse there, and he did the timing measurements. Comparing the timing measurements from the coast of Newfoundland to the timing measurements of the lunar eclipse in the UK meant you could measure longitude. This was a big deal. Such a big deal that he became chosen in an agreement by the Royal Society and the Royal Admiralty to lead an expedition to Tahiti to observe the transit of Venus to measure the size of the solar system. Along with that came special orders. Those orders were special and sealed in an envelope that told them to go and discover Australia, ignoring the fact that, you know, already discovered. So along with the science, he was bringing the British flag with him around the world. While the transit of Venus was an important result, it came with a price. Furthermore, at the time of the Enlightenment, where we celebrate Isaac Newton and great scholars like that, we were beginning a trade of people from Africa to the Americas and back. And during that trade, it became a boon for science. Haiti was today, Haiti or Saint-Domingue, was a center for this trade. Many, about two-thirds of slaves at one point went through this island. Astronomers were hired to help map the longitude and the location of the island in great detail to better make more efficient the travel. Scientists like Newton and Halley, Edmund Halley of Halley's Comet, asked sailors to map the tides and the phases of the moon from each port of call, therefore using this trade to benefit their sciences. Not to mention how much money some of these scientists earned from these trades, as Newton, being the head of the Exchequer, was. So we use astronomy to benefit our colonization and travel. And part of this is, you know, to build navigation and better star maps. But it's telescopes that actually strike me as most interesting in how we colonize Canada. The first telescope known in what becomes Canada was brought to Louisbourg, Fort Louisbourg. This was a French fort for a long time, eventually lost to the English in one of the wars. But the scientist, Joseph Bernard Chabert, brought his telescope to Louisbourg in 1750 to do observations and to work, do science from there. I don't think he did a whole lot of science. He left a year later. I don't think he liked it. But that was the first telescope. Today, we have telescopes all over what we call Canada. Whether it's the David Dunlap Observatory in Richmond Hill, the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory outside of Victoria, the DRAO, and in this case, and as well as the Algonquin Radio Observatory, just to name a few. These telescopes are spaced all over what we call Canada. They all have a history of being built on Indigenous lands. A particular interest to me was the David Dunlap Observatory, which was built after the university bought land from a farmer. All well and good. What we don't know is where that money came from was from mining in Northern Ontario on Indigenous lands, presumably without having Indigenous people working those mines to earn money or have a lifestyle they choose. And the land was a part of the treaty that has a small problem that no one actually talked about how much land was in it. So where Richmond Hill lies may have been outside of the agreed upon boundaries. And this exists all over Canada. And to my knowledge, no one asked the Coastal Salish peoples if they wanted the Dominion Astrophysical Observatory in Victoria. I don't know if we ever asked the people in, around Kelowna and Kamloops if they wanted the Dominion Radio Astrophysical Observatory. This is kind of important because this is still itself colonization and the taking of land for photons. This is also true for the observatories in the United States, which have a far more egregious history. Here is an image of Kitt Peak. Kitt Peak was signed over by the local Tohono O'odham in 1958 after years of negotiation. There have been numerous scholarly works on this, particularly by Swamner, whose thesis was published in 2013. But in the discussion, the National Science Foundation, who led this initiative, negotiated with the elders of that nation for a while for the rights to use Kitt Peak. This was kind of, while that might sound benign, this was less than a century after the Indian Wars, for which the Tohono O'odham lost hundreds of people, thousands of people, to the US soldiers. So it's not clear that they necessarily felt they were equitable partners in this negotiation. What happened, and as Kitt Peak was one of the sacred mountains, was that they signed a lease for about $2,500 per year for 200 years. This is a lot of land. Can you imagine buying this land for $2,500 rent per year? I don't know how many people live in Toronto, but compare that to the rent of your apartment. One of the perks that people like to spout for this is that the people, the Tohono O'odham, were allowed to have a gift shop to sell baskets. This history became to the front in sense in the 1980s when lawsuits about this came to be, particularly with the construction of new telescopes. In this case, one being aptly named Veritas, that is now built and operating on the other mountain, Mount Graham, if I remember correctly, that they thought Veritas was going to be built on Kitt Peak, but the lawsuit said the NSF had violated their Historic Preservation Act by not consulting with the tribe. And Veritas was canned. This wasn't the only telescope that faced significant issues on Kitt Peak. Or sorry, not Kitt Peak, Mount Graham, which is the other large mountain in the Tohono O'odham region that is of spiritual interest. Now, Mount Graham is not part of the reserve system there because US politics, the Tohono O'odham were given a significant amount of land at the turn of the century, and that land kept being chopped and chopped and chopped for various usage. And in this case, in the 1980s, they were going to build the Columbus Telescope to celebrate the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus. I don't think anybody, I think everybody could kind of realize that that would be in bad taste today. But instead of listening to the local Apache people, the US government forced legislation through to compel the construction of these telescopes. This, by the way, is now the Large Binocular Telescope. So at least it's not called the Columbuscope. And so in this situation, all telescopes and observatories in Canada are on Indigenous lands. But Canada doesn't build telescopes in Canada anymore. Well, not entirely anyways. I can't forget about CHIME. Almost all astronomical facilities Canada operates are in other nations because, particularly in the optical, Canada is not, there's not very many places in Canada that are good sites. Their other sites are way better, particularly Mauna Kea in Hawaii. This is a center for astronomy, if not the center for astronomy. And Mauna Kea, at being the largest mountain in the world from its base under the ocean, contains 13 facilities, some of which have now been shut down, but not yet decommissioned. And as part of that decommissioning process, Canada, Japan, India, the state of California, and a few other parties are trying to build a 30-meter telescope. As the name suggests, the telescope is 30 meters, because astronomers are imaginative people. And this telescope will be bigger than football fields and will be a multi-story building on top of Mauna Kea. But the irony is, it wasn't originally meant for Mauna Kea. The original plan was to build this in Chile. It had a very promising site in Chile until things changed when the state of Hawaii engaged and asked to try to come back up north. And when they did, I think things changed that made people realize that Mauna Kea is Hawaiian as a native Hawaiian. And Hawaii has a very unique, or has a unique history when it comes to engaging with the US. It was a kingdom that was annexed through military occupation. And, you know, so even though it's a state, it is still native Hawaiian lands. And as part of that, Hawaiians decided that they didn't want TMT. They didn't want the 3-meter telescope for a multitude of reasons. Mauna Kea is a spiritual site. The danger of the 30-meter telescope to certain species of insects, the impact on the mountain of increased traffic, and so on. But it became a fight where protesters were blocking the one road. And this isn't a new battle. The reason TMT wasn't originally meant for Hawaii was because they've gone through this before. The Keck telescope, two 10-meter telescopes on the top of Mauna Kea, wanted to build outrigger telescopes for the purposes of optical interferometry. But they ended up being sued by the Office of Hawaiian Affairs about this because they didn't meet environmental standards. They also faced a couple other questions. You know, the policy for building telescopes on Mauna Kea requires you to get a environmental process for each telescope. Whereas a lot of the point here was that this was not a new telescope, it was part of the existing facility, even though it would be an independent source. It's also interesting, the choice of outrigger. For many Hawaiians, the outrigger telescopes was a clear attempt to connect to the canoeing, the boating tradition and outrigger boats. To make people feel like Keck belonged there and was local. But they did not meet the environmental requirements, and NASA soon blocked or defunded this project. But it became an issue of consent. You know, nobody asked the Hawaiians for consent for those outriggers. Likewise, the construction of TMT is a question of consent and indigenous rights. And I say this in the exact same sense that we talk about Standing Rock, Wet'suwet'en, and so on, where people try to build oil pipelines through indigenous lands. That is an issue of consent and whether they will accept it. This is the problem for many astronomers. Do we respect indigenous rights? Are we willing to sacrifice our big telescope to preserve those rights? And it's notable that the Canadian National Community, CASCA, as part of its long-range plan 2020, so 10-year plans for this decade, has agreed as one of its major recommendations that no facilities be built without Indigenous consent, following the guidelines set by the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. That sounds well and good. It sounds like this shouldn't be an issue. Like TMT is not going to go there if Indigenous people say no. Except, what if we're manufacturing consent? TMT went through numerous consultation processes in the last decade. It's going through another consultation process through the National Science Foundation, which as part of the recent decadal survey in the US, based on the recommendations, it has agreed to provide funding for two large, extremely large telescopes, one being the 30-meter telescope, the other being the giant Magellan telescope in Chile. And so through these sessions, the NSF is gauging whether they can provide funding for the TMT project, which is grossly under budgeted at this point. While at the same time, we have not done anything to express what it means to deal with the protests or land protectors. This image is from the protest only a few years ago, where indigenous elders were arrested for being on the mountain. People who are grandparents, great aunts, great uncles, were arrested because of a telescope. And that should raise red flags for everyone. It's also worth noting that as part of that discussion at that time, the governor of Hawaii threatened to bring in the National Guard to clean up the protests. Before the pandemic, I was in Honolulu for a conference where a Hawaiian elder, who was one of the ones arrested, stood there and said he threatened to call the National Guard. The National Guard are called for flooding, earthquakes, and apparently too many indigenous people. This is what our telescopes are right now. And this is true because almost every large telescope is on indigenous land. Our radio telescopes, optical telescopes in Australia, Hawaii, southwestern United States, Chile, South Africa, and so on. And we want to build even bigger telescopes. We have the very large array for radio astronomy, and we're going to be the extremely very large array. Astronomy really needs to work on these acronyms. Which is going to be basically another kilometer or kilometers across, which will span Mexico and multiple states in the United States, crossing multiple indigenous territories. We have not done any work on consent. The Square Kilometer Array is beginning those processes in Australia. We've done nothing in Canada for the telescopes here. And same process is true for the radio telescopes. So we took it, this is the Event Horizon Scope, great images of black holes. And we give Hawaiian names for them, but it uses indigenous lands for all these things. The problem is we want to decolonize astronomy or physics or whatever, but we can't. We have to be a bit honest about this. We can't decolonize astronomy while building telescopes on the backs of indigenous peoples. We can't decolonize while manufacturing consent and treating and being unequal partners. We can't decolonize while pretending token initiatives are good enough. It's wonderful we named an asteroid Oumuamua. The question being, how much did that cost relative to the cost of the observations using the various telescopes? One is a very small number, and that ain't the observations. That's a token initiative. It's nice, but it doesn't really do anything. We can't decolonize unless we create space for not just indigenous knowledge or just bring people in. We have to recognize that we're on indigenous lands and do things about that. We can't do astronomy on indigenous lands and pretend that we're okay. And having said that, keep an eye on my clock. Colonization is not only telescopes. It's also light pollution. This, we agree, is a problem. So many of my colleagues have written and discussed Starlink and the wild fantasies of Bezos and Musk and which other uber-rich, insert bad word, person in the world. But light pollution is a huge part of this. We live in a world where we just waste light everywhere because we're afraid of the dark or something. And it is part of that colonization that erases our connection because it erases our constellations. It removes them. And the satellites to go with them that are coming up at the same time are also part of that colonization. This is the image become famous from South America of all these starlight paths crossing over a telescope. And if some of them can be seen with the unaided eye, that means, light pollution erases stories, erases constellations, and these satellites are going to rewrite them. Now, that's just my personal opinion, because, the fun thing about Starlink, it brings internet to places. And many indigenous people are in places where we have never put fiber optic cables. So, in this current era of having to work remotely, needing access to broadband internet. Starlink is also important for many peoples. So it's not one, it's not necessarily good or bad, it's not one or the other. It's that we have issues with both, and there are many opinions on that. In that respect, our view of the night sky is colonized. But so is the sky itself. This is the map of satellites orbiting the Earth in different orbits. It looks almost like a giant garbage dump in the sky. And while many of these satellites are useful, most are, some aren't. But we're taking a lot of space. And this was a big deal, even in the 60s. With the Outer Space Treaty was signed in 1967, that space was not the domain of any country and was for the benefit of all, to use their words, mankind. But with the realization of geosynchronous orbits, a lot of the countries underneath that, which were poorer than the United States and Russia, realized that they should be getting benefit from these geosynchronous satellites that are over their heads. And they said no. So not only can you not claim land, you can have your access blocked by having other countries build the satellites over you. And this is kind of part of the issue. We're dealing with, you know, a new economy where satellites are going to be put everywhere, base hotels, and so on. And we have to deal with this as astronomers and scientists who use the night sky, use telescopes on the Earth. And as part of that, the American Astronomical Society brought together scientists and group policymakers, outreach coordinators, planetarium people, amateur astronomers, and so on, under the Satellite Conference 2. And full caveat, I was one of the members, one of the participants chosen by invitation. One of the working groups was the community engagement panel, where this contained people who worked in planetariums, amateur astronomers, and so on. But the indigenous people were just one party. We were a stakeholder in a Western argument. The reason I want to bring this up is because this is the part of the tokenism. People were invited by the organizers of this panel. So who did they invite? People they knew. That's what you do, right? Probably people in astronomy, which means they had opinions that would likely agree with them. Like mine, I personally think the satellites are a bad idea. But there's also a First Nation in Washington State who's getting free internet from Starlink. So they might not see it the same way. But they weren't invited. And so we have to face this issue of not only are we working in a community fighting for what's called space environmentalism or so on, but we're tokenizing voices. A particular paper that boils my blood, is something called, was a paper called Case for Space Environmentalism. Sounds like a great idea. We should be thinking about what we're doing in space and how we're polluting it. But this paper, and like many others before it, take indigenous knowledge and say, if we don't do something, the indigenous people will suffer. If we don't do something about space, well, we'll lose those stories. And in this case, with space environmentalism, that they spend 5 seconds or 2 words quoting indigenous knowledges and citing one of the authors who was non-indigenous, his blog. But not only were they using indigenous knowledges, they weren't even citing it properly. And this idea of the case for space environmentalism is something that's commonly done in a lot of environmental movements in North America. That is to use indigenous voices as a shield. I mentioned, you know, protests against oil pipelines, where indigenous people agree with environmentalists, it works. But if you want to talk about the seal hunt and seal furs, the environmentalists shut down Inuit voices who were harmed dramatically by those protests. So the problem being is neither of these works that I just mentioned, even though I participated in one of them, engage indigenous peoples in an equitable way. These discussions were not designed to listen to indigenous people, but to manufacture indigenous support of the astronomy group. This is the challenge, and how we be better inclusive. To do better, I think we need to remember one thing. Canada is built on Indigenous lands. So is the United States, for that matter. And this map shows the treaties that Canada or the Crown has signed, whether it is the Peace and Friendship Treaty, Northern Treaties, the Number of Treaties, and so on. The spots that aren't have treaties are unceded lands. Well, it's all unceded land, to be honest. But just because there's no treaty doesn't mean we don't respect Indigenous rights. The reason this is important, and to my mind, is there is no height limit in a treaty. The various governments who did treaty negotiations wrote a lot of things in them. At no point, and I've dared a lot of people to find it for me, did they say this treaty only works up to a kilometer height. Now, I'm going to go on a limb and say if this were brought to a court of law, it would get laughed out. But I think if we, as people who work on these lands, think about these things, space is a part of these unceded lands. That means if we are working on things like SATCOM or perspectives of internet, how we explore space, how we do astronomy, we need to remember that we're operating on Indigenous lands and space is part of that Indigenous lands. That's not a claim or a country doing something. It's just a reality that's part of our lived experience. And as part of the lived experience, Indigenous peoples must be consulted. So I think it's worth trying to end here with some thoughts. If we're going to live on these lands as that are Indigenous and work in these spaces that where we have to respect indigeneity and Indigenous peoples, we should ask what we give back. I mean, astronomers, our job is to take from the sky. Now, that sounds kind of glib since what we're taking are photons. And, you know, that's not exactly an environmental problem. But we do take them, and we use them for our own benefit. And I think we need to give back. We should recognize, I think our current view of the sky is dehumanized. We treat the sky as dead. The moon is dead. Mars is dead. I urge everyone to read the work of Alice Gorman from Australia, who has noted this perspective of deadness. And that changes how we interact with it. If the moon is nothing but a rock, who cares? The moon is a being for many people. It is a grandparent, it is a relation for many peoples. And that means if we go to the moon and do things, we have to change why and what we do there. And rethinking this view is very important. We need to go from this dead bear with a tail that Zeus grabbed and swung over his head and threw into the sky to Muin or the great bear in Cree or bear and his cubs in Northern Europe and so on. It is so wonderful that what we call the Big Dipper actually represents a bear constellation almost across the world in many different ways. In the same way that when we talk about the Pleiades as the seven sisters, in almost every culture it is seven beings. Even though, depending where you are, you can only see six stars, maybe even eight, sometimes eight. And we need to return to those stories. We should remember that our research and teaching, if we're going to live on this land, should include Indigenous knowledge and methods. We should be listening to knowledge keepers and elders, not blowhards like me. And I think what's most important and hardest to do is to think about the intrinsic rights of things in space. Do we get to just go to the moon and blow it up, mine whatever we want to do, or go to Mars and drop asteroids, do whatever? We have to understand what the consequences of those things are. Maybe they themselves have their own rights. This is not a new concept. New Zealand, a river was given awarded human rights by court based on Maori tradition. So the river was governed, basically a guardianship of Maori people and settler people, to protect it from overfishing, hydroplants, and so on, to keep it as pristine as possible. And it's not the only place in the world that has human rights. So with that, I'll thank you with all the honor.
So we have time for some questions. Are there questions? Oh, Josh, I don't know, I don't know what that means. Lee, can you speak?
Yes, can you?
Oh, there you go. Yes, we can hear you.
Great. I want to tell stories very. When I taught astronomy at Syracuse University, there was a person working for me to help as the course. And at one point, she told me anonymous, and she was complaining to be an elder and was taught astronomy, you know, astronomy as part of it. So we talked about it, and I suggested that she invite the elders who were teaching her to come and teach my astronomy. And that way, I thought that that would be an interesting thing to do, to start a conversation. But in this case, the elder refused and sent back the message that that knowledge was not for sharing or communicating. And I thought that was too bad. In the other story, I'll just say, I won't tell the story, but I happened to meet and get to know a Maasai elder who was visiting Toronto. And when he heard that I was a physicist or a cosmologist, he got very interested. And we spent most of the day on a walk with him asking me questions. Now, I just want to contrast those two attitudes. Surely the indigenous people of the earth, who I support most of what you say, would like to cooperate with the rest of the knowledge-seeking people and help to gain knowledge and help all humans gain knowledge. And I don't know why their attitude with respect to these telescopes and so forth is not one of pride, that is, the indigenous people of the earth can make a special contribution to the knowledge of the earth by letting the world use these telescope sites. And what I fear is that there is not goodwill on the other side, and the same. And I fear that the Onondagan elder did not want to share or have compared her astronomy with ours.
So I think there's a lot in those stories. And I think from the elder's perspective, some knowledge isn't meant to be shared because knowledge is a responsibility. Like I said, it's an action. And so how it gets shared is very sensitive. So for instance, there are stories that are only told when there's snow on the ground. And it's important to recall these things. I would also say, I understand someone refusing to share their knowledge. I mean, we live in a land where the society or Western society has taken so many things, medicines, children, and so on. And it's very possible that this elder can share their knowledge and the community will receive nothing in response, nothing at all for it. So, you know, when indigenous people give, what are we giving back? That's, I think, a huge question. That's an issue.
May I give an answer? If the big medicine wheel can be used and was used by indigenous people to predict the solstices, with a little bit more sophistication, it might be used to predict eclipses. And wouldn't they like to know that? Wouldn't the elders like to know if their ancestors were able, using this machine that they built, to predict solstices and eclipses? Wouldn't we like to know?
I'm sure we would like to know. I'm also sure that many of them already know that maybe those devices weren't themselves directed towards eclipses, but some were. A lot of elders knew about eclipses and knew how to predict them. That those knowledges existed. Just because we haven't verified it doesn't mean it wasn't there.
Sure, but wouldn't you like to verify? Wouldn't it be an interesting thing to know? It's not that easy to predict an eclipse.
I think there's an interesting conversation here, but I'm going to turn to the audience here in the auditorium, okay? Are there questions here? Is there anybody in the room here?
In the back.
Okay.
I have taught as high school astronomy, and when you talk about sort of the textbooks and how we don't have indigenous content in it, I completely agree with you on that. My concern is that I also don't teach Greek astrology, right? I don't teach the zodiac signs. So the concern I always have is differentiating between sort of the indigenous myths and the stories that go along with them and the Greek mythologies and stories that go along. I don't teach that either in my my stuff. I'm stuck with the Greek names. And so my question, I really, like, I'm feeling kind of challenged by the way you presented it, that about the colonization and how we don't teach this stuff because of colonization. So I have to think on that. Part of my justification where I didn't teach is I really felt like the way it was being presented, it was either, okay, I'm just going to replace this astrology with indigenous stories, or, okay, here's the cute stories that the First Nations people have. Now I'm going to teach you what we know. And I never felt qualified to do it correctly. So, like, can you help me out? How would you want this presented in a class?
It's very hard. Like you said, it's if you don't know how where the knowledge is coming from and what it's about, how do you do anything other than a cute story? I think where I would start is looking at the Greek asterisms, which are there because we choose them. They were arbitrarily chosen how many thousand years ago? And I also push back on the argument that in astronomy, we do kind of teach Greek astrology. If we talk about Ptolemy, the solar systems, all those things were built around astrology as much as astronomy. So they're all part of that kind of conversation, even though we don't say it. But when we do this, I think we should acknowledge that this was a choice. And saying that this is the constellation is not true. It could be Muin, it could be the Great Bear, it could be the Cradle, it could be so many different things. In the same way, we choose to call it Mars, or we choose to call it Neptune. It could be anything you want, for Mars, it is different words. And I think recognizing that those cultures exist as well on these lands, particularly on these lands, is an important step forward. It may be that you can't tell these stories, but there are resources, you know, there are videos from Wilford Buck, who's a Cree astronomer, Annette Lee, who is a Lakota astronomer, and so on, telling these stories of the same constellations that you can use. And that would help. For me, it's not the either or, it's people from different places tell different stories, and this is the choice. I think the way we do it in our textbooks is because we're so inundated in the classical scheme going from Aristotle up onwards that we sort of start with that as the names of the constellations. You know, I don't know what a Camelaridus is. What, a hybrid camel and a giraffe? You know, who was drunk that night? So, you know, I think we can come up with ways of including all the different stories related to this land. And for me, that's the key, is whose land are we on when we tell these stories?
There's another person
with a hand raised on the Zoom screen.
Yes, you.
Hi, I'm Luna. I'm new here. Thank you very much for your talk. So you mentioned the story of rather what happened with the medicine circle, which is known as, you know, medical device from indigenous knowledge, but there was this archaeologist and maybe archaeoastronomer that sort of suggested that this might be also used as for astronomical observations. And so rightfully so, this is an indigenous knowledge because it was sort of an archaeological hypothesis. And so to my mind, one of the great sort of one of the great things to get over when thinking about indigenous knowledge, not just astronomically, but really in any field, is this sense of the past, that Native folks belong in the past when there are very much present and vibrant Native communities and Native knowledge today. And so my question is sort of, where do you see the role of cultural astronomy or archaeoastronomy in this? And to what, you know, do you see it as helping or as hurting by placing sort of indigenous folks who are very much alive in here further into the past, sort of erroneously? Do you have any comments on that? Thank you.
I have so many comments. So I think archaeoastronomy is fine. I've read and studied a fair bit of it. You know, you see it done in Europe and churches and religious, and that's great. We should have more of that. And if we're doing archaeoastronomy in the Americas, we should follow a lot of the same protocols that archaeologists do. I think where I would turn around and change things is, I don't believe there should be a distinction between cultural astronomy and astronomy. Because really the difference is the astronomy we do is, we call astronomy what we do as astronomy, and everything else is cultural. But when I study cosmology, dark matter, or whatever, which are arbitrary names, some of them poorly, that's culture. That in itself has cultural astronomy background. And so in my mind, all astronomy or all science is cultural. And calling indigenous knowledge as a cultural astronomy is not, I think, is just a way of othering it. And so I don't think I'll ever win that battle, but when people just say cultural astronomy, I just shrug. It's just astronomy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm gonna turn. I don't think I'm gonna make it, but.
Hello. So this is more of like a statement than a question. I think it's important to sort of increase the probability of discussion, especially with tomorrow and everything. So I think part of what Lee was speaking to with the discrepancy between indigenous people wanting telescopes on their land is because indigenous representation in science is abysmal. We do not feel represented, or that our stories and our histories are respected in the field when it's been historically used against indigenous people, right? Basically everything we know about Mayans' understanding of astronomy that they built over tens of thousands of years is from a few books that were by accident not burned during the Crusades. And from that, we know that they can predict eclipses thousands of years in the future. So part of the way forward, I think, in my mind, is creating a space that indigenous culture is respected and valued in science, and bridging the gap between astronomers just trying to use indigenous lands to it being the indigenous astronomers themselves using the telescopes on their lands. I think that would sort of soften the clear distinction that we face today. But I'm very open to other people's discussions and to hear what other people have to say. But I think that's important.
My opinion when it comes to telescopes, it's consent or no consent. We can, if we want to open up and create space and all these things, we should be doing that anyways. Part of the challenge with that is the 30-meter telescope claims to do that. But it'll do it at $1 million a year. Its operating budget, 25, 30 million a year. Token money. And this is part of the same history. You know, Mauna Kea is built on a science preserve. That land in Hawaii gets referred to as ceded, which means it's under the auspices of various Hawaiian governments for the benefit of Hawaiian peoples. Any monies raised on those lands go to Native Hawaiians. What they did was they gave gave the telescope lease $1 a year for so that the University of Hawaii can have time. So instead of Native Hawaiians getting money, the University of Hawaii got the benefit. And it could benefit people in terms of science and learning, but you know, that's a large infrastructure for very few people that have benefited. There are great Native Hawaiian physicists and astronomers in the world, some who are for the telescope, some who are against. But it's a big ask to put on the backs of indigenous peoples for equity, for things we should be doing anyways. So I don't really worry about the telescopes. If people don't want them, they don't want them. Why don't we try building a telescope in Manhattan and see how well that goes? If we wanted to clear that same amount of space in Manhattan, there'd be a lot of protests for anything. So my opinion is I think we're asking a lot of indigenous people we would never ask of ourselves.
Thank you.
Hello? No, I just wanted to ask if you have any book recommendation to learn about indigenous peoples of Canada's astronomy knowledge.
One of the best books ever written is Native Science by Gregory Cahete. It'll tell you all the indigenous methodologies and ways of knowing. It doesn't go so deep into astronomy, but it is a gateway, I think. So that's my recommendation.
I think with that, we're going to...